Coming up in just moments, a conversation about online sales and taxation. My guest is George Isaacson, a constitutional law professor and partner in the Lewiston, Maine firm of Brann and Isaacson. Mr. Isaacson represents multi-channel marketers and electronic merchants throughout the United States in connection with state sales and income tax matters, as well as regulatory issues. He will be a featured speaker at the National Tractor Parts Dealer Association conference held in Arizona in January. You know, you as a consumer may buy online, but what hoops must the seller jump through when it comes to taxes? That story is coming up next.
Insight on Business, the News Hour with Michael Libby is made possible through the support of Tarot International. The Tarot trainers are experts in helping you and your business to achieve, lead, and outclass in every situation. Learn more at tero.com.
It is the Business News Hour. Thanks so very much for tuning in again today. We have on the phone with us on our newsmaker line, George Isaacson from his offices in Lewiston, Maine. He is with Brann and Isaacson, and it's a law firm that specializes in a whole myriad of things, and in particular, as we said in the opening credits, we're going to be talking about tax law as it pertains to online sales. George, welcome to the Business News Hour. Good to have you here, sir.
Thank you, Michael. I've been looking forward to talking with you.
This is a fascinating conversation about to happen because what our tax laws and how people are buying and selling everything from tractor parts all the way to toilet tissue has changed drastically with more and more individuals buying and selling online. And because you teach constitutional law and because you have appeared before the Supreme Court on two occasions, you are an expert in the area of multi-channel retail tax. And so let's just chat a bit about that, can we?
Sounds good to me.
What are people who sell products online, what are they faced with right now, Mr. Isaacson?
Well, you know, I think a good starting point is to realize that part of the original genius of the American Constitution was to create a single national marketplace. In fact, that's what the reason for the original convention was, that following the Revolution and during the period when the country was governed by the Articles of Confederation, the problem was that states were erecting barriers by taxes and duties and tariffs between trade among the states. And so one of the main features that the U.S. Constitution established more than 200 years before the European Common Market came into existence was a single national marketplace that would be free of interstate trade barriers. And the Supreme Court had been quite vigilant in terms of protecting that, making sure that companies could buy and sell without having to contend with barriers to that trade. For a very long period of time, for a period preceding 2018, the standard in regard to sales taxes was that a state could impose a sales tax collection obligation on a retailer if that retailer was located in the state.
Yes.
The sales tax in the United States actually began during the Depression period, when property taxes were ineffective because homes were being foreclosed, the income tax was ineffective because people were not making an income, and the original sales tax was called the penny tax, that a penny would be charged on every dollar, and it could be easily collected over the counter by the merchant. And so it was very consistent with the trade at that time, that the Supreme Court said that a state could only impose that obligation on a company if they're actually physically located in the state. And moreover, a company that's located in the state and has employees who live and vote in that state was a participant in the process to make sure that the tax laws were not overly burdensome on those in-state retailers.
So this was our legal system and our tax system for decades and decades. Is that right?
Absolutely. And a system that the U.S. Supreme Court had confirmed in two major decisions going back in time to 1967, 1992, the Supreme Court had confirmed that a state can only impose that obligation to collect taxes if the company is located within the state, has yes. physical facilities and employees within the state. What the Supreme Court did in June of 2018 was to say that because of the change that has been resulting from electronic commerce, that the notion of physical presence was no longer applicable, and that instead what the court would permit is states to impose tax collection obligations if a company had an economic presence in the state. In other words, if it was selling goods or services to residents of the state, even though the company was not physically present there. I think on the surface, that sounds fairly logical, that the economy has changed, that internet activity has increased, and therefore economic presence is a good substitute for physical presence. The problem is that our tax system was totally unprepared and unsynchronized for that purpose. So in the United States, we have over 12,000 sales and use tax jurisdictions.
Oh, my.
It's not only states that have sales taxes. Counties have sales taxes. Municipalities have sales taxes. Sports stadium districts have sales taxes. Airport districts have sales taxes. Even police and library districts have sales taxes, with many of these jurisdictions overlapping. In addition to that, there are a number of states that have home rule jurisdictions in which those jurisdictions have a different tax base and have different tax rates than the state level. All of the states have disparate arrangements regarding the way the transactions will be treated, how products are defined. Farm equipment may be defined one way in one state and a totally different way in another state. And the same thing is true for apparel and sports equipment and candy and food.
Oh, sure. It's all over the board, especially when we talk about farm equipment. In some states, the sale of farm equipment is not taxed, and in others, it is.
And, you know, it wouldn't be that bad if there was a uniform definition of what's farm equipment.
Sure.
But when you have a company that needs to not only determine what is the rate, but also then determine, is farm equipment defined the same way in the different states to which I'm selling farm equipment? Because the very same item may not fall within the definition in one state and therefore not be exempt, but fall within the definition of another state and be exempt. So what has happened is we really have a crazy quilt of sales and use tax laws and requirements. And the burden falls most heavily on small and medium-sized companies, on family-owned businesses, on startup companies, in which the promise of the Internet, which has been that you can host a website and sell throughout the nation with very little burden in regard to figuring out what the local requirements are in regard to the different sales tax requirements and rates. Now the obligation is to be compliant with literally thousands of different tax jurisdictions. And the penalty, if you are not compliant, is very severe. So a retailer that is selling over the Internet that gets it wrong, and it's very easy to get it wrong, is itself liable for the tax that it had failed to collect. And not only is it liable for the tax, it's also liable for penalties, usurious interest rates, and states are very eager to audit companies and to hold them liable for taxes, especially companies that aren't located in their state, because they view it as found money with
sure.
that local company not having any political recourse to say that the tax system is unfair. So what we've encountered is a really serious problem in which taxes and business are not aligned. You know, a comment that I'd make, Michael, that I think is important in understanding this from a higher perspective is any good tax system should make sure that its ability to raise revenue without overly complicating the process and burdening businesses and impeding economic growth is so important. And what's happened now really is that the cost of tax collection to the online retailer is oftentimes greater than the amount of tax collected.
Is that right?
I'll give you just an example without naming names of companies, but there's a company that I'm familiar with in Arizona, a small company that has $6 million in annual gross sales, has 30 employees, family-owned, the kind of business that you want to encourage, and which has seen the Internet as a real opportunity for expansion and growth. That company reported that they spent $155,000 in terms of tax compliance software, increasing their accounting staff in order to accommodate the requirements of various states. $155,000 spent on compliance last year to raise about $61,000 in taxes.
Oh, my.
It cost them $155,000 to come up with $60,000 of tax revenue that then was remitted to the various states. And that is typical. And that kind of inefficiency is a real indictment of the tax system as it stands now. And something needs to be done about it.
Our guest is George Isaacson, and he is a multi-channel expert in the area of taxation. And we're speaking to him on our newsmaker line from his office in Lewiston, Maine. George, you have painted a very grim picture. And I would suspect, let's say if I am a retailer of some kind and I live in, let's say, South Dakota, and you said that states are very actively out there pursuing some found money, and perhaps I have been selling things in a far-off state like Washington State, for example. Does the state of Washington, they just look at this and they say, well, I wonder if this corporation in South Carolina has been collecting the appropriate taxes. Can they just send them a bill?
What they will ordinarily do is first send them an audit notice, and they'll tell them that it appears from research that they've done, and there's a lot of research available on who's selling online, that you are an online retailer who is not currently collecting Washington State sales tax. Washington, by the way, also has a business and occupation tax, so there's a double barrel that Washington State has in addition to its sales tax. We want you to give us what your sales have been since we've adopted this new expanded sales and use tax law. And if the company ignores that demand for information, then they will be subject to what is called a jeopardy assessment. The
sure.
state will just make an estimate of what their tax liability is, which will always be much greater than what the actual exposure is. Or if the company then does respond and voluntarily provides the information, they'll take that information, determine what the uncollected tax is, and send the company a bill, which in the tax world is referred to as an assessment. One of the real pains that's associated with this is that if that South Dakota company, in the example that you've given, believes that either the amount of the assessment is incorrect or the basis for the assessment is incorrect, they have to go to Washington State in order to appeal that tax assessment. And they have to go through a torturous process, first of administrative review, and then going into the courts. Many companies, and especially smaller companies, the cost of protesting a tax assessment could run into literally the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars, substantially greater than the amount of the assessment itself. So it's not unlikely that a company will say, I think I have good grounds for objecting to this tax bill, but I can't afford to challenge
it. Right, so they pay the bill. George Isaacson, ladies and gentlemen, is our guest. You've set out a really onerous issue here, George. If 12,000 different tax entities out there in the United States, what is the answer at the end of the day when we look at this problem for online retail sales? What should happen in the United States to fix this?
So the solution to this is really not that complicated. Congress has the power to require that if states are going to impose tax collection obligations on companies that are not located in their states, then what they need to do is conform to certain simplification requirements. And Congress has that power. There have been proposals in Congress in that regard. The states are obviously opposed to it. The states say that this is a matter of state sovereignty. We should be able to design our tax systems without any obligation to coordinate, synchronize, conform to any standards. But it just doesn't make sense to have products that are defined differently, even though they're the exact same product from one state to another. I'm not talking about a common tax base. You can still have a menu of products from which states can choose what will be taxed and what will not be taxed, but that menu has common definitions. You could have a central clearinghouse in which companies remit the sales tax to a clearinghouse, and the clearinghouse then distributes it to the different states and localities. There's a provision like that, by the way, in regard to fuel. Trucking companies a long time ago agreed with both the United States government and with Canada to what's called the International Fuel Tax Agreement. And trucking companies that obviously are traversing across state lines compute their sales tax based upon their own determination of what their mileage has been. And then in a single spreadsheet, they remit that to a clearinghouse, and the clearinghouse then distributes it to the states. Those kinds of simplification measures really, really do work. And there's a number of improved uniformity, improved simplification provisions that have been drafted in proposed legislation. And what's really necessary is for the business community to get behind that and to demonstrate that these burdens are hurting the national economy and that states can obtain their revenue without the complexity that the current system imposes.
His name is George Isaacson. Ladies and gentlemen, we've been talking about the issue of interstate commerce as it appears to incapacitate and really cause some great harm from the standpoint of taxation in the United States. George, thank you for your time. I really do appreciate this. For full transparency, you and I will be together in just a couple of weeks in Arizona. And both of us will be there on behalf of the National Tractor Parts Dealer Association. I look forward to sitting down with you and perhaps even expanding this conversation.
I look forward to it as well, Michael. Thanks for having me on your program.
Thank you, sir. Be well. Once again, that was George Isaacson from Brann and Isaacson of Lewiston, Maine. We will have links to that website up on our radio blog. Well, that about wraps it up for another broadcast day. Thanks so very much for being with us. For all of us associated with the Business News Hour, Chap Ramsey is our production coordinator. Sales and marketing falls to Aaron Libby. The voice of the Business News Hour is Hunter Pease. And the music you're listening to right now is arranged, composed, and conducted by our friend James Goodlett, exclusively for the Business News Hour. For all those folks and for George Isaacson, my name is Michael Libby. Have yourself a wonderful day. Be safe, be well, be careful, most of all, be good to your fellow man. Good day.